Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm Martin Rees, the President of the Royal Society, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you to these premises. We at the Royal Society are the UK and Commonwealth's Academy of Sciences and have been celebrating our 350th anniversary this year with a number of events. And the Royal Society is privileged to host this very distinguished gathering this evening to celebrate a real step change in the scale and fortunes of the Oxford Martin School. And I'm pleased to be here, not simply as the Royal Society host, but for other reasons too. I've known James Martin for a number of years. I've admired his achievements as a computer software pioneer. I've admired the vision and idealism which has led him to speak and write about the threats and opportunities confronting our society in the coming decades. And above all, I've admired the magnificent generosity which has led him to endow this institution at Oxford that bears his name. I'm privileged to be a member of the school's advisory council, so I'm here in that capacity too. The school's mission is to tackle the challenges of the 21st century. And all it does is motivated by one key realization. And I'd like to put this in an astronomical perspective. The Earth has existed for 45 million centuries. But this one is unique. It's the first when one species, ours, will have enough dominance to determine the future of the entire biosphere. There are more of us than ever before. The population will rise to about 9 billion by mid-century, and we're all more demanding of resources, energy, food, rare minerals, and other things. We risk degrading biodiversity and irreversibly changing the climate. And these are the challenges facing us. The answer to all these challenges is not to slow down technology, but it's essentially more and better technology. And we think of information technology, biotech and nanotech. All these offer huge prospects for the developing and the developed world. The solution is absolutely not to slow these down, but to better direct our efforts in science and technology. But what's very important is that we need not just science and technology, we need social sciences, economics, ethics, and politics. They're all crucial too. That's at least in part because as science advances, there's a widening gap between what can be done and what should be done on ethical, prudential, or strategic grounds. Another feature of all these issues is their long-term. Problems and choices are very long-term, and the problem in politics is that the urgent always trumps the important. And they're also very often international. No country can tackle them alone. And that's why the broad perspective and reach of the Martin School is so valuable. It involves groups of experts embedded in many different departments of Oxford University, and they collectively can not only stimulate long-term thinking, but they can also catalyse interdisciplinary research. Well, that explains why I am an enthusiast for what is happening at the Oxford Martin School. That's enough introduction from me. I now want to hand over to the director of the school, Ian Goldin, and he will introduce the rest of the programme. So may I hand over now to Ian Goldin. Thank you very much.
Lord Rees, ladies and gentlemen, friends, it really is delightful to be here on this very special night for us when we celebrate what's about our fifth birthday, but also a huge leap forward for the school. We have bold ambitions, which are to tackle the challenges of the 21st century. And we've just been enormously fortunate to benefit from the vision and generosity of James Martin in making this possible with an initial endowment, and now with his new gift, which we've matched, which will more than double the size of the school. What you'll see tonight is a little sample of the sorts of things we are doing. You'll hear from five of us out of the 30 different groups that are currently working in the school. And I hope this gives you a flavor of the breadth and depth, the interdisciplinarity, the scale of the issues we're dealing with, but also their relevance and impact. We don't only aim to advance research through doing new ways. We aim to make a difference to the world. What I want to share with you is some of my own work, and some of the perspectives I bring to this, as well as some of the things that we're able to harvest from the school as a whole. What's remarkable, as Lord Rees has indicated, is the breadth and depth and the ability to bring people from many, many perspectives. And being in the Royal Society, which for 350 years has put science at the service of humanity, is a particular privilege. And it's as Lord Rees has said, it's bringing this together in new ways. Now, we're not trying to predict the future. The best minds, at the cutting edge of their technologies, habitually get the future wrong. And this is true in technology, it's true in politics, and of course it's certainly true in my profession, economics, where over 20,000 PhD economists didn't see the financial crisis coming. So we're not trying to predict the future, but we are trying to embrace it. We're trying to change the way that the world interacts with the future by doing research which is future-facing, both in the reasonably short term of the next decade, but also looking out over the whole century. The remarkable thing about this time we live in is the pace of change, the pace of development. There has never been a tidal wave of globalization such as we are experiencing now. And this has been associated in politics with the democracies coming to 60 countries, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the opening up of China, and many other developments. It's been associated in economics with capital market liberalization, many other developments. And of course, it's a technological leap. And these are, as economists would say, endogenous. They feed off each other. These forces accelerate and lead to a more rapid change. So we've had marvelous benefits from this. Our connectivity allows us to be here, allows us to draw knowledge from the whole of the world, allows 300 million school kids that were never educated before to have opportunities for the first time. It's brought immense benefits, and we're trying to understand these and how to spread them more widely, how to ensure that globalization may be more inclusive. And we have a very strong project working on this, to ensure that it becomes more stable, that everyone is able to enjoy this, not just a very few. And we're also trying to understand the systemic risks that globalization spreads. I'm fortunate tonight that we're joined by many of our colleagues from different directors in the school, including, though, Angela McLean, who is the co-director of our group on pandemics. And what we saw with the swine flu is, within a very short period of time, spreading to 142 countries. So we know that globalization doesn't only provide the benefit for a rapid evolution of the benefits or the goods of humanity, but also, as we move forward, a much more spreading of the bads. And of course, we've seen this with the financial crisis, which stopped only after it had enveloped the world, after starting in small communities in the south of the US. So how do we ensure that globalization is a more stable force, a progressive force, and doesn't lead to systemic risk? Now, we've been remarkably successful over the past generations in managing the big explosive threat of nuclear war, which hovers over us constantly. The new dimension which the coming years will bring is that individuals, for the first time, have the power to wreck the planet. Very small groups of individuals are developing an enormous power. And this is not only in areas of biopathogen and other terrorist threats, but it's also, of course, through what individuals can do through industrial mistakes, through reputational mistakes, and in other ways. So how do we understand these choke points, these nodes? How do we ensure that we disperse risk more effectively and are able to harvest the benefits of globalization and manage the challenge? The other massive change of recent years is the evolution of a commons that was a community commons into a commons which is global. And as we see in the disappearance of the Aral Sea, and this is a project I was involved in unsuccessfully in a previous job, is the inability of individual groups of actors to collectively do the right thing. although rationally they might individually be doing absolutely the right thing. So what we do for ourselves as rational actions, and as nation states even as rational actions, when we aggregate them at the global level, are disastrous. And as we move forward into the 21st century, this problem of planetary management or managing the global commons will become more and more pressing, and we see it particularly now in climate change, but in other areas. We're trying to draw the lessons of some of the successful management experiences, and this is the Mediterranean Sea, which was restored from being really in dire straits to a place where you can enjoy and swim in safety through the collective action of over 20 countries. What was it that allowed that to be successful but not the Aral Sea experience, and how may we take this forward in the future? We know that we have to provide the sorts of opportunities to the many that few now can afford. So leapfrogging technologies, ensuring not only that technologies are developed but that they are widely adopted, that they become technologies which assist those that want to, for example, have that transport, is a key dimension. And we know, too, that the most difficult challenge, and again one that I'm personally involved in, is the reform of the global institutions. Whose hands are on the tiller of the planet? Who's going to help us steer through this extremely complicated set of issues? We know that this set of institutions is fossilized. It's not fit for 21st century purpose. But how do we get from what we've got to something which is going to help us in the future years? That is perhaps the biggest challenge of all. And it's one that requires the coming together of people with very, very different disciplines. That's the sort of purpose that the 21st century school is for. And I hope as you hear from my colleagues, you'll get the sense from them too. I'm going to start by giving the floor to Sarah Harper, who's the co-director of the Institute of Aging in the 21st century school.
Thank you. The Institute of Aging works within the Martin School with other institutes to consider the challenges of population aging and how they're going to interact with other 21st century challenges. One of the key statistics that I think is most significant is that within 20 years, half of Western Europe will be aged over 50. We've never had a region of the world where half the population is aged over 50. And at the same time, we will have a quarter of the developed world aged over 65 and a quarter of Asia aged over 60. But it isn't just the growth of older people that is going to dominate. It's also the falling fertility leading to a lack of young people. And it's falling fertility and increasing longevity that is leading to the structural aging of the globe. And here, if you look at the countries that are marked red, blue, and green, they represent countries that respectively will have one-fifth, one-quarter, and one-third of their population aged over 60 by 2050. And indeed, only Africa will remain young. We at the Institute believe that scientific research must address key policy questions. So we work with international organisations to develop strategies for our ageing world. The World Economic Foundation, International Social Security Association, World Health Organization, for example. And I'll go through these as we look at our research. It's very clear that we're going to have to adapt our financial systems to increases in longevity. And we are working with 1.3 million pension records here in the UK to try and understand the drivers of longevity. Governments across the world know they're going to have to promote the productivity of older workers, and it's thus essential that we understand the capacity changes as we age. So we've linked with Oxford brain scientists to understand how the brain ages normally and what the capacity implications are. And we've recently done work for the oil and gas industry, whose workers are ageing rapidly, to try and understand how they can change their working environments to cope with their older workers. In terms of health for the 21st century, we're going to see a shift from acute medicine across to public health and chronic disease. And we're joining with the New George Institute to address some of these issues. For example, work that we're doing with the Japanese at the moment on robotics. Here we have an intervention study with something called a therapeutic robot. And the intervention study showed that on Japanese patients with Alzheimer's, there was a significant decrease in anxiety and stress, and an increase in concentration. And we're working to see whether culturally Britain could adopt that kind of a robotic. It's also clear that this new global world of older people is going to rely increasingly on families and communities to sustain it. We've linked with Oxford engineers to tackle one of the issues in China. Here, the one-child policy has reduced the potential number of older adult children who will care for aging relatives. And we're working with the Chinese to see if we can create technological communities that can replace children. We're also going to live in a world that's going to be increasingly mobile. And it's going to be essential that we have the institutional international structures to allow the mobility of healthcare, pensions and skills, for example. This builds on some work we're doing on the migration of healthcare workers. Here we have two different societies, Taiwan and the UK, but both increasingly using foreign workers to care for their frail older population. We believe that by 2050, half the population of our cities will be aged over 60. And so we have linked with other institutes in the Future of Cities project, which is run by the Institute of Science, Innovation and Society. And this means that we can address such questions as how can we design age-friendly and eco-environmentally friendly cities? And here we're working with some Japanese colleagues on this. This kind of scientific research leads to a variety of public policy outputs. Over the last year, the Institute has worked with Swiss Re and the World Economic Foundation on their economic challenges of ageing societies. We've done a report with the Environmental Change Institute on for DEFRA on providing food in a future world of food scarcity to vulnerable people. And we've done work with the ISSA on social security in an ageing world. We're contributing to the Foresight Global Environmental Migration Programme on trying to understand the interactions of migration, ageing, and the environment. And we're also involved in the Royal Society Working Group on People and the Planet. This, however, I think is going to be the key question for the 21st century. Can we ensure that across the globe we see the increases in longevity that we have experienced in the developed world? How can we ensure that this child in Africa, who currently has a life expectancy of around 35, will enjoy the healthy life expectancy of those in Europe and North America? This girl from Mongolia, she should be the older woman of tomorrow. But is it that she is going to be able to experience the kind of longevity we're not talking about here in Europe and the US? The kind of radical longevity where pharma and the new genetics and biotechnology means that we are looking at the possibility of a normal life expectancy of 100 or 120. And this is something we debate with the Institute of Biosciences. And for us, the thing about being in the Martin School is that we can work with scientists and technology, people who work on governance, to ensure that someone like this girl has the possibility of a healthy life expectancy as her colleague, as her peers in Europe and North America do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Professor Susan Lee is the co-director of our Institute of Vaccine Design.
Well, I think we're very much amongst the new members of the Martin School, and we're beginning to learn how exciting an environment it can be to work within. I've been asked to introduce to you today the very diverse work and our very bold aspirations within the Institute for Vaccine Design. So we've just been told that the population is ageing and that acute disease is much less of a concern. But actually, acute disease, even in this antibiotic and antiviral era, is still a major concern across the world. And in fact, there are many people within the world whose life will be either cut short or destroyed in terms of its quality by infectious disease, and often relatively simple infectious disease. World Health Organization says that about a quarter of all deaths annually are because of communicable diseases, and these are what we're looking at. And in fact, within these diseases, there are a very small number of diseases which are responsible for a large number of the deaths. Malaria, which many of us are aware of as something that we take some pills before we travel, but actually cerebral malaria kills over 1 million a year. Meningitis, which again, our children are probably all vaccinated against meningitis in this country, but actually there's still strains of meningitis which we can't be vaccinated against. And across the world as a whole, again, about 1 million children lose their lives to meningitis every year. We all know that HIV is an ongoing issue, although somewhat moderated due to drug regimes, which now give people good life expectancy, but the drugs are expensive and difficult to access, and therefore only available to a minority of the sufferers. And finally, and surprisingly, pneumonia, pneumococcal disease, still kills more than 1 million children every year. I think this is something that many of us had come to think of as a disease of old age where people gradually faded out. But this is very much an active problem in young children. And then diseases which institutes such as Angela's Institute are looking at have the potential, while at the moment not causing that many deaths, only 200,000 after all to influenza last year, but we're worried about the way in which these viruses can change so that they will suddenly be much more of a burden on our population. So antibiotics and antivirals have been wonderfully successful, but what our institute is hoping to do is to follow in the legacy of Jenner to develop vaccines. And this is really because vaccines can be given when you're not sick. They can be given in a timely fashion with some ease, and therefore they're often much cheaper, more effective ways. Jenner is credited with having saved something like 500 million lives to date, through noticing that if you were infected with a relatively mild disease, cowpox, you were protected from the very devastating disease, smallpox. The problem with this is that it's proven to be very difficult to adapt Jenner's technology to make vaccines from those diseases I was talking about earlier. And so what we need are new ideas and new ways to come up with vaccines that will provide protection against these very difficult diseases. So within the Institute, we're hoping to bring together people who think about disease from a very wide range of perspectives to come up with genuinely novel ideas for how to design vaccines. And in particular, we want to take everything from the very basic level of surveying what diseases are doing, how they're changing in response to their hosts and to the world out there, modelling them to try and better understand that, breaking them down to study the fine detail of how they work, and then translating this all through to the clinic to actually develop new vaccines. And so we have people that are involved in all these areas of science, both within our institute and in the interactions with the other institutes within the school. I'm just going to tell you a couple of stories of ways in which we're trying to develop new vaccines for some of those diseases at the moment. This is actually part of the surface of HIV. And it's a picture which, for me, illustrates why this virus is so difficult to tackle with a vaccine, because all the blue things that you see surrounding there are made by the human host that the virus is living in. And this is therefore very difficult to recognise as being something from outside of us because it's covered in us. So we're using technologies which allow us to target vaccines against cells which are infected by the virus rather than the virus itself. And in doing this, we hope we'll be able to tackle this very difficult problem. We're working also in collaboration with a lot of other people, and this is actually work on providing vaccines for the strain of meningitis for which we currently have no vaccine in the West, meningitis B. And this is work that's being done in collaboration with Novartis. And there's one vaccine already in phase 3 trials in conjunction with Oxford. And my group have recently solved the structure of the molecule, which is the active part of that vaccine. And this has allowed us to understand what this molecule does for the bacterium. And what it actually does is it steals proteins from our blood to make it look more like us, to allow it to evade the immune system. So by some simple tinkering with the molecule, now we can see its structure, we can redesign it to get rid of that function. And we hope that this will make a much better vaccine. So we're working with Novartis to now get this molecule into the pipeline for vaccine development. The other thing we want to do is we want to use our technologies to make better vaccines. And vaccines might be better because they provide broader protection. An example of a vaccine where we might want broader protection is against influenza. And this is actually a small additive to vaccines which significantly increases the strength of the immune response. And we hope that by using additives such as that, and by understanding influenza better, we may be able to design vaccines which are truly pan-influenza vaccines, rather than needing to be changed every year as the strains that circulate change. The other way in which vaccines might be better is by making them more stable. The stretch and reach of vaccination is really very limited because so many vaccines at the moment have to be kept in relatively bulky solution forms, which then have to be refrigerated, and this significantly limits access to them. And other groups within our institute are using the biology of these resurrection plants, which are wonderful things, which can be completely desiccated, survive very high temperatures. And then with the addition, when they reach the final growing conditions, they recuperate because they're full of very sticky sugars. And this technology has been adapted to allow vaccines to be travelled into the field as dried down vaccines on filter paper. And then working with other engineers, we've developed this very simple system shown at the bottom here, which means that all you need to vaccinate a community is some sterile water and a box full of these filter papers, and you can then reconstitute the vaccine as you inject it into the person. So we hope that using technologies like this, vaccines which currently can't be shipped to communities which need them, will be able to reach them. The World Health Organization declared the world a smallpox-free zone during the 20th century, and in the 21st century has aspirations to cure the world of a couple of other diseases, specifically poliovirus and a couple of others. We actually think with a bit more investment at this time and a bit more clever thinking this early on in the century, we should have the ambition to think that the 21st century could be the one in which we really either eradicate or just reduce to an unimportance many of these other diseases. And that's what we hope that people will enjoy doing by working with us in the Martin School to achieve this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. Professor Steve Rayner is the director of the Oxford Martin School's Institute of Science, Innovation and Society, and he's also one of a group of professors, four professors, that co-direct our project on geoengineering, which cuts right across the school, and he'll talk about that this evening.
Thank you very much, Ian, and good evening and welcome. As Ian has already indicated, the Oxford Geoengineering Programme is a remarkably interdisciplinary activity that cuts across the geological sciences, the social sciences, the engineering sciences, and brings in also the humanities. What is geoengineering? The Royal Society last autumn issued a report on the topic in which it defined geoengineering as the large-scale intervention in planetary systems in order to try to counteract the effects of global climate change. Why would you want to do that? Well, at least one of the answers is represented in the graph here. This shows a range of projections from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for potential temperature rises under varying socioeconomic conditions over the course of the next century. We would like to be on the bottom of this curve. Unfortunately, with emissions worldwide currently growing at about 3% per annum, we're actually on the top of this curve. We seem to be headed to about a 2 degree Celsius temperature rise by mid-century, with a possible 4 degree rise by the end of the century if the trend continues. And it's quite possible that these estimates are wildly optimistic, since built into these are certain assumptions about improvements in energy intensity and carbon intensity, which it turns out have not held true. So one of the things that people are thinking with respect to geoengineering is it would be very handy if we could find ways to shave the peaks of these kinds of emissions profiles whilst pursuing more conventional methods of carbon emissions mitigation. And I want to emphasise that there are almost no serious person working in this field of geoengineering who accepts the Freakonomics guy's idea that this could be actually a substitute for conventional mitigation. But it could well be a way of buying essential time. How might we do it? Well, there's two things you can do to counteract the effects of climate change, and there's two ways you can do either of those things. You can either suck some carbon out of the atmosphere, which is what the Royal Society report described as carbon dioxide removal, or you can reflect a bit of sunlight back into space, which is what the Royal Society described as solar radiation management, or SRM. Now, you can do either of these things, suck carbon out of the atmosphere or reflect it back, in either of two ways. You can enhance some natural processes, or if you prefer, tinker with some natural processes, or you can actually do it through traditional heavy black box engineering. So you can see in the matrix here, for example, ocean fertilization. We know that certain parts of the ocean are less productive of plankton than they might otherwise be, and that the idea here is that by adding iron to those parts of the ocean, one could enhance plankton growth. The plankton would take up carbon from the atmosphere. Fish would come along, chomp up the plankton, and then the heavy fish poop would sink to the bottom of the ocean. Unfortunately, in the field trials so far, a lot of the plankton were eaten by jellyfish, which have like floaty poop, and the carbon went straight back up again. But nevertheless, this is the general principle that you're looking at. Stratospheric aerosols is another potential option. I say this is a natural system that we already have. Volcanoes do, in fact, loft sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere when they erupt, and we know when Mount Pinatubo erupted, for example, for about a couple of years we had a global 2-degree modification of the temperature. On the other hand, if you want to do either of these things through black box engineering, you could build big machines, illustrated in the bottom left, that suck carbon out of the atmosphere. By the way, we do this in submarines. It's very expensive at the moment. but it's not entirely inconceivable that we could do this on a large scale, or put something reflective into space, either large reflectors or more likely probably a myriad of small reflectors. So you have these various options. What are the downsides? Well, one of the downsides is the potential for socio-technical lock-in. If you rely on sulfate aerosols to cool the planet and you continue to emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and then for some reason, such as you discover you've disrupted the Asian monsoon, you decide you have to stop, then you're likely to get a very sudden and very disruptive temperature rise. So that's a sort of technical lock-in. Now you might say, well, there's not much lock-in with carbon capture machines, you just flick the switch and they go off. That's true from a technical point of view, but considering they're likely to be fairly expensive, you can imagine that there's going to be a fairly high degree of institutional lock-in, commitment of vested interests of those who have made the investment in constructing the machinery, such that you would have strong pressures, as indeed you do now, from the oil and gas industry with respect to fossil fuels, not to turn them off. So there are potential downsides. So how would we manage this area of technology? Do we need an international agreement? Do we need to manage or govern research and development as well as implementation? Indeed, where does the process of research and development in these processes stop and full implementation begin? You start with doing computer models, you go to bench level experiments, you go to field trials, you go to full scale field trials. Hang on, if you're at full scale, haven't you already started implementing the technology? So it seemed to us that there was a necessity to have a set of principles for governing geoengineering that would cover the full range of processes from those early experiments right through to implementation, as well as covering this very wide technological field of possible options. And building on the work of the Royal Society's Geoengineering Working Party, of which I was privileged to be a member, we gathered at Oxford a small group of academics, including colleagues who had been involved in that report, Catherine Regwell from University College London and Nick Pidgeon from the University of Cardiff, and proposed to the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee a set of five principles that we felt would govern all of these technologies and could cover this full range of process of research, development, and full implementation. What impact did these have? Well, they were considered at some length by the House of Commons Committee, and we were very pleased to say that the House Committee felt moved to endorse the Oxford Principles, as they've become known. I had the privilege to take these then to a major international meeting at Asilomar in California earlier this year, which was an attempt by the geoengineering community to emulate that of the recombinant DNA community at the famous Asilomar meeting on recombinant DNA a few decades back. And The Economist, as The Economist reported, the Oxford Principles were widely accepted by the participants in the Asilomar meeting, and they certainly seem as though they're going to be part of the next phase of the Royal Society's so-called Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative. So if we're unsuccessful, I think we might end up like the guy on the right here, but I think the stakes are so high here that we really can't afford not to succeed. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve. Another group which across the Oxford Martin School is joining links is that of the group on ethics, law and armed conflict, and I'm delighted to have David Roden, co-director, here this evening.
Thank you very much, Ian. Well, as one of the major problems of the 21st century, the problems of war and conflict have a number of distinctive features. First of those is that these are genuinely existential threats for our species. Nuclear weapons that we were very exercised with during the Cold War have not gone away. Russia, the United States, the United Kingdom retain arsenals that are capable of eliminating all life on the planet. Many of these weapons remain on hair trigger alerts, and we know that these weapons have been proliferating at an extraordinary rate in recent years. In addition, new forms of weapons of mass destruction are coming online. Here we see a particularly nasty form of weaponized anthrax. So it's an existential problem. But unlike a number of potential existential problems for us, war is killing people now. We know that the 20th century was by far and away the bloodiest century in human history. It killed approximately 180 million people. And despite coming down from these huge peaks that we see here and represented by the First and Second World Wars, war is still killing at an extraordinary and unacceptable rate. Thirdly, war and conflict engages questions of technology at really the two extremes. War is a very old problem. Famously, it's one of the four horsemen of the technology. Horsemen of the apocalypse, and it embraces both the very high tech. So here, for example, we see a U.S. pilotless Reaper drone, which is capable of delivering a very lethal ordnance, such as a Hellfire missile, on pretty much any spot on the planet. And yet, it's directed by a civilian operative sitting in front of a computer terminal in Langley, Virginia. So raising here really huge issues of how we think makes sense of killing at such extraordinary geographical and psychological distances. So the very high tech on the one hand, on the other hand, the extraordinary low tech. Rwanda, 1994, approximately 800,000 people are murdered in the space of about 100 days using machetes, clubs, and other improvised weapons. And increasingly, we're seeing the very high-tech and the very low-tech co-mingle together in particular areas, as we see, for example, in Afghanistan at the moment. The final feature of war and conflict is that these are intentional harms. Now, this makes them really crucially different from many of the other problems that we face in the world today. Think about problems of climate change, pollution, inequality. These are harms that are, as it were, side effects of other processes that are themselves goods. Right? There are side effects often of wealth generation or other goods. War is really distinctive because it is an intentional form of harm. What we do when we go to war is we intentionally harm, maim, and kill other human beings. We engage in forms of behavior that in almost any other setting would be seen as morally outrageous and probably also criminal. So, of course, this raises the question of whether part of the solution to these problems is not a solution of regulation, management, and norms. And this really raises the great question, as it were, that we are dealing with here. Can we, through regulatory processes, through law, through norms, regulate and mitigate war and eventually, of course, eliminate it? And if we can't eliminate it, can we at least mitigate some of its worst dangers and worst atrocities? This is really the kind of the Herculean challenge, the great intergenerational, multi-generational task that we're engaged in. Can it work? Well, I think that there are some grounds for optimism. And paradoxically, one ground for optimism is the very weakness of the regulatory structures that are in place at the moment. And this comes right to the very fundamental conceptual apparatus with which we approach these problems. The laws of war are still substantially dominated by what the so-called just war theory, developed by this gentleman here, Thomas Aquinas, and his predecessor, Augustine, writing in the 12th century AD in North Africa. So, you know, this is one of the few areas of contemporary modern life that is still dominated by an intellectual structure that is genuinely medieval. So huge scope here, huge possibilities for genuine innovation. And I'm pleased to say that the Institute has been a part of that in recent years. The attempt to legally regulate war and conflict, again, still in its infancy. The first real war crimes trials take place after the Second World War in Nuremberg and in Tokyo. The Geneva Conventions are developed and extended in a period from 1949 through to 1977. And it's only in 2002 that we have, with the establishment of the International Criminal Court, the first permanent standing international criminal tribunal. Now, these are real, genuine advances and achievements, but huge challenges remain. And at the Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, ELAC, we're trying to approach these challenges at three levels. At the level of basic theory and ethical principle, at the level of law and legal instrumentality, and finally at the level of politics and enforcement. So we are a collaboration between three disciplines: philosophy, international law, and politics. And we're really unique in having this value chain of thinking about these set of problems. No other group anywhere in the world does this, and our ability to do this is entirely due to the extraordinary support and amazing context that is an opportunity that's given to us by the Martin School. So it's a really unique initiative in this area. What are the issues that we're dealing with? Well, the first of those are issues around who gets to decide who uses force and in what context. The issue of authority to go to war. The traditional view was that it was a state prerogative, clearly can't be accepted. But we know that there are huge problems with the Security Council of the United Nations. Can we think about better models of authority? Can we learn, for example, from the way that authority emerges, as it were, spontaneously in distributed computational systems, for example? Secondly, norm generation, or norm innovation. Generating new bodies of legal and moral principle, as, for example, in the work that we're doing on the emerging idea of responsibility to protect, the idea that all states have a shared responsibility to prevent, protect, and intervene in cases of mass atrocity and genocide. Integrating ideas of human rights into our understanding of the laws of war. One of the great achievements of the last 60 years has been the almost universal acceptance of the idea that all human beings have a basic package of fundamental rights, no matter who they are and where they come from. But how do we square this with the way that we think about basic aspects of the laws of war? For example, the traditional idea that soldiers have a right to kill enemy combatants, even if that enemy is fighting in a just defensive war. For example, many people believe that the war in Iraq was unjust, but they do not hold responsible or blame the American and US soldiers that went to fight there. There's a real question, I think, about how coherent that is. Finally, we work with the soldiers, the practitioners themselves. We've found this to be an extraordinarily effective way of getting real policy impact, rather than trying to engage the public or policymakers in an attempt to alter the context within which practitioners work. We go to the practitioners directly. And a good example of this is a project that I'm doing at the moment with the US Army at West Point, helping them to develop their first ever code of professional military ethics. This will be a watershed document for the US Army. It'll provide a baseline for the action of all of their 1 million personnel in all of their actions, both in barracks and in operations. And it's one of the ways that we're trying to pick up on Jim's extraordinary challenge to take our thinking out of the classroom, out of the university, and into the policy sphere. Thank you very much.
So the characteristic of the school's work, as you have gathered by now, is the interdisciplinarity and the relevance. And we do a lot of very big, complex modeling. We're using a lot of the supercomputing facilities at Oxford. And it's a delight as well to have Tim Palmer, who's running our climate modeling group here this evening. But this evening, Pedro Ferreira, who is the director of our group on cosmology, is going to explain why it is that we were convinced that cosmology should be part of the solution for our 21st century challenges.
Well, what you have up on the screen is a survey of galaxies. Each one of those points is a galaxy. This is a data set taken by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. It observed over 8 years from a telescope at Apache Point and build up this data set. The survey should have about 1 million galaxies. I've only plotted about 300,000 of them. And what you see is something incredibly rich. You see big agglomerations, you see voids, you see walls. You see something that we call the cosmic web. Now, why are we interested in the cosmic web? Over the last 100 years, cosmology has given us a way of looking at this data set, something like this, and extracting fundamental properties of the universe, how fast it's expanding, how heavy it is, what it's made up of. By looking at the way that this data set is structured, we think we can say something about the very beginning of time, about the Big Bang. So basically, we want to take this data set and we want to access this knowledge about the universe which is in it. Now, that's the challenge. It's very difficult to get this knowledge out of this data set. Buried in this complexity, buried in all this structure, buried in this imperfection, is that information. It's not just sitting there. We can't just harvest it. We can't just take it out. And this is what we're facing in cosmology at the moment, and I think many fields of science and knowledge are facing. So I'm just going to give you two examples of how we have to tackle something like this, a problem like this. You have a data set, and you want to extract information. You basically, one of the things you want to do is you want to compare it to a model. And what we're trying to do here is model the universe. I'm going to limit that a bit. We're trying to model the visible universe, something which is about a billion light years across, which is peppered with about a billion galaxies. And each galaxy has about 100 million stars, 100 billion stars. So you can see it already that it's just something immense. This universe follows the laws of physics that we understand. On the one hand, we want to get everything right on the very largest scales. We want to model the universe. On the other hand, we want to be able to extract bits of this model that look like what we see around us. We're buried in the Milky Way, which is something on much smaller scales. So you have to come up with methods of simulating these very disparate scales. And this is an attempt at doing this by some of my colleagues in the project. This is the Mare Nostrum simulation. In this simulation, and what you're seeing here is these wisps of light are basically galaxies, distributions of galaxies, those same galaxies that you saw in the data set. This simulation was run on I'm going to show you a picture of it, a beautiful supercomputer, which is basically housed in a chapel in Barcelona. It's the very postmodern supercomputer. But this simulation took about 4 months to run on tens of thousands of processors. This simulation pushed this computer to the limits. It's designed, basically, you want to run something which simulates something on this scale. It pushed the limits of this machine. And it's been used, for example, to recalibrate, to redesign this machine. It really is one of the biggest simulations of this type ever done. Now, these are the kind of scales we're facing. We need to run codes like this on very big machines, but we also need to access this information. And one of the things that you realize with a simulation like this is you run it on such a supercomputer, and you can't just download the data onto your desktop. You need supercomputers to analyze the data which was run on these supercomputers. And so that's one of the challenges that we're facing. How, even though we have these models, how do we make them not just black boxes? How can we extract the real information from the simulations? So this is one example of the type of challenges we're facing. Another challenge is that survey, they had all those white dots. Now, each one of those dots is a galaxy, and each galaxy is a personality in its own right. Here's a selection of galaxies on the screen. Some of them are spiral, some of them ellipticals, some of them are neither. They're called irregulars. And what they look like, their shapes, hold a lot of information about the evolution of the universe and the actual state of the universe. And we would like to access that information in these galaxies. Now, it turns out that computers aren't very good at getting these images and telling you what they are. They get a lot of it wrong. They will say that a spiral is an irregular. They might say that an elliptical is a spiral. There aren't very good methods of actually classifying these galaxies using computers. Humans are much better. You have, in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, you have about a million galaxies, so you're not going to get half a dozen researchers going through a million images classifying them. So one of my colleagues who's sitting in the audience here had the brilliant idea of setting something up called Galaxy Zoo. Now, with Galaxy Zoo, it's a site, or a website, where any member of the public can access it, can log in, and they'll be shown a picture of pictures of galaxies. And for each of these pictures, they're asked a few simple questions. The original question was, is it spiral? Is it elliptical? Here are slightly more subtle questions. And basically, they look at each picture, they classify them, and then they see another picture, and they can do many pictures along the way. Now, it's interesting because people are really enthused by this. Just to give you an idea of how well this has worked, this has been around for about 3 years, and in 3 years, we've had something like 150 million classifications by 300,000 people. So it's an incredible success. The public really want to take part in the doing of science. And it's not just the simple doing of science, of just doing these rote procedures. They're fascinated by seeing these images of the cosmos that very few people have actually seen. But more than that, they look at images like this and they look for stuff in them. So very interesting. One of the very interesting things that's come out of this project is people look at these images and they found these green dots, which, you know, no one was looking for. And they started talking to each other on the forums connected to this website. And they realized that they were in lots of images. And they convinced the astronomers to go out and look at these things properly. The astronomers went out and looked at these things properly and found that indeed these green things were sites of star formation, incredibly important places where stars were being born. So that came out of the public's access to the data, and it drove the science in these data sets. So here is an example of where you have these masses of data sets and you harness the public to help you do your work. Now, things are going to get worse or better. It depends on how you look at it. These are two telescopes which are in the making. One is the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is going to be based in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And the one below is the Square Kilometre Array. It's a radio telescope which will be possibly built in South Africa, possibly in Australia, possibly in both. And this takes the game to a completely new level. Basically, these instruments will videotape the whole visible universe. What will come out of these instruments is time shots of a billion galaxies. Not a million, a billion galaxies. So the data challenge is even more immense than what we've been facing. Now, it's pretty clear, it should be pretty clear, that the problems that we're facing in cosmology are very similar to the problems that are being faced in a number of scientific fields, in biodiversity, in economics, in climate science, in oceanography. And we believe that the methods that we're developing can be applied in these other fields. Let me just give you an example. The Zoo Universe, which is kind of the umbrella for the Galaxy Zoo. In the next few weeks, we'll be launching a project where they'll be taking ship's logs from the First World War, and they'll be asking members of the public to extract information from these ship's logs, things like the temperature of the ocean, the temperature, the wind speed, things like that. In doing so, members of the public will basically amass a very clear and precise and accurate map of the weather around the world during a period of time in the past. At the same time that they're accessing these fascinating bits of information, these ship's logs, where lots of things are going on. And there are a number of examples that we're working on where we're basically using the methods that we're developing and we're looking outside our field and seeing how they can be applied.
Thanks very much, Pedro. So looking around the room, I see many colleagues and friends who have got opportunity out of the Oxford Martin School, who've helped us form it and who I hope will help us drive it forward in the future. But there's one person that we all really are here due to his vision and his creativity and his enormous generosity, and that is Dr. James Martin. And it's with great pleasure I ask him to take the floor.
Lords, ladies and gentlemen, and my wife. The great historian, Neil Ferguson, described Britain in the 17th century as being economically unremarkable, politically fractious, and strategically a second-class entity. But Britain went on to create the largest empire the world had ever known, encompassing 43 colonies and 5 continents. It covered a quarter of the Earth's surface, and encompassed a third of the Earth's population. And that extraordinary greatness, almost unequaled in history, still exists today. And all over the world I meet Englishmen doing various things, not living in England, many of them, who are great people. So there's a huge upheaval beginning now in the world, and I think the time has come to say we want to make Great Britain great again, recognising the greatness that has happened in the past and bringing that back as far as we can. The City of London was the finest financial centre, and it will be again. The London Theatre is by far and away the best in the world, and I say that as a person who loves Broadway. The utter brilliance of the Royal Shakespeare Society is absolutely incredible. When I was young, Britain had the best film directors: David Lean, Carol Reed, Laurence Olivier, Hitchcock, Ealing Studios in the 1990s, an Englishman who is here today, by himself, all alone, created the World Wide Web and put the code he wrote onto the internet, and this took over the world. Now he wants to go a stage beyond that and create a semantic web, which means that the web will understand the meaning of many of the messages which are travelling over the web. And if that gets completed, it will once again completely transform the web into something which is of extreme value. At Oxford in the New Martin School, I see the greatness of Britain. Absolutely extraordinary people. In all different areas, the school is now attracting many people to the various new institutes that we've got. And I don't think there's anything else like this in any university in the world. I don't think there's any university which does multidisciplinary research. And many of the big problems, all the big problems of the planet, all the big opportunities need not just one discipline, but many different disciplines, all linking together. And so that's what the school is about, connecting the different disciplines. Now, in Oxford, you can do things which you can't do at most other universities, because Oxford is brilliant at politics, it's brilliant at ethics, it's brilliant at engineering, it's brilliant at mathematics, it's brilliant at computing, and so on, particularly at politics. Chris Patten was introducing the new school for government last week, and he made the comment that Britain has educated 36 of Britain's prime ministers, except, he said, that two of them were undereducated. So there are many forces that are joining together. Now, Oxford now has got a scientist at last as the vice-chancellor, and I think Andrew Hamilton, a wonderful name, will have the capability to make Oxford absolutely the finest and most innovative university in the world, replacing Cambridge as number one. And so we should be saying to young people, we will win the battle for the planet. At the Oxford School, we'll change the way we harness sunlight by using organic photovoltaics. At Cullen, the director believes that he can create small-scale fusion. There's a huge trauma ahead to get over the problems we have today. In 1941, the University of Bristol was bombed by the Germans just as they were about to have their graduation ceremony. And so the vice-chancellor called up Churchill and said, we've got to close the university, we can't have the graduation ceremony. And Churchill said, you will have the graduation ceremony. Get everybody in the most colourful robes possible, get the best orchestra you can find, get a platform in the middle of the rubble and keep the fires burning, and I will make the commencement speech. And Churchill came down there and did that. And in the middle of the speech, he looked at the audience and he said, you know, as I look at you, as I look into your eyes, I see the eyes of an unconquerable people. I think we should say to young people everywhere that we are going to win the problems that are ahead. We will save the oceans. We will save the forests. We will prevent economic crashes like 2008, although there will be new types of global economic risks now. We will find solutions to the great problems of the planet. But as well as doing that, there are great opportunities to make the world better, to make civilization much better. And so I believe we'll be creating new civilizations in this century, greater than anything we've seen in history, in parts of the planet at any rate, a new renaissance. So there is trauma ahead. But during that trauma, I think Great Britain will be helping to recover from the trauma that we see in this century. And I believe that our grandchildren will look back and say, this was our finest century. Thank you.